And yes, as I said, this is Ms. G, and I am bringing you Telling Tales with Ms. G. This is our new title. It's still left hanging as far as the wonderful stories go, but we decided to change things up a little bit. So, for tonight's story, I wanted to give you another wonderful story for tonight and our last night of, Women's History Month officially. And tonight's story is titled The Blue Men by Joy Williams. So I'll give you a moment to get settled, and I'll be right back with Telling Tales with Ms. G. And this is Ms. G, and I am bringing you Telling Tales with Ms. G. And tonight's story is by Joy Williams, an REA Awards book winner for 1999, and it's titled The Blue Men. Bomber Boyd, age 13, told his new acquaintances that summer that his father had been executed by the state of Florida for the murder of a sheriff's deputy and his drug-sniffing German Shepherd. "It's a bummer he killed the dog," a girl said. "Guns, chair, or lethal injection?" a boy asked. "Chair," Balmer said. He was sorry he had mentioned the dog in the same breath. The dog had definitely not been necessary. "Lethal injection is fascist, man. Who does lethal injection?" a small, fierce-looking boy said. "Florida, Florida, Florida," the girl murmured. "We went to Key West once. We did sunset. We did sloppies. We bought conch shell lamps with tiny plastic flamingos and palm trees inside lit up by tiny lights." The girl's hair was cut in a high mohawk that rose at least half a foot in the air. She was pale, her skin flawless except for one pimple artfully flourishing above her full upper lip. "Key West isn't Florida," a boy said. There were six of them standing around, four boys and two girls. Bomber stood there with them, waiting. May was in her garden looking through a stack of 100 photographs that her son and daughter-in-law had taken years before when they had visited Morocco. Bomber had been 4 at the time, and May had taken care of him all that spring. There were pictures of camels, walled towns, tiled staircases, and large vats of colored dyes on rooftops. May turned the pictures methodically. There were men washing their heads in a marble ablutions basin. On a dusty road, there was the largest pile of carrots May had ever seen. May had been through the photographs many, many times. She slowly approached the one that never ceased to trouble her. A picture of her child in the city of Fez. He wore khaki pants and a polo shirt and was squatting beside a blanket upon which teeth were arranged. It had been explained to May that there were many self-styled dentists in Morocco who pulled teeth and then arranged them on plates and sold them. In the photograph, her son looked healthy, muscular, and curious, but there was something unfamiliar about his face. It had begun there, May thought. Somehow. She put the photographs down and picked up a collection of postcards from that time, most of them addressed to Bomber. May held one close to her eyes. Men in blue burnouses lounged against their camels, the desert wilderness behind them. On the back was written, "The Blue Men. We wanted so much to see them, but we never did." May and Bomber were trying out their life together in a new town. They had only each other, for Bomber's mother was resting in California where she would probably be resting for quite some time. And May's husband, Harold, was dead. In the new town, which was on an island, May had bought a house and planted a pretty little flower garden. She had two big rooms upstairs that she rented out by the week to tourists. One was in yellow and one was in gray. May liked to listen to the voices in the rooms, but as a rule, her tourists didn't say much. Actually, she strained to hear at times. She was not listening for sounds of love, of course. The sounds of love were not what mattered, after all. Once, as she was standing in the upstairs hallway, polishing a small table there, her husband's last words had returned to her. Whether they had been spoken again by someone in the room, either in the gray room or the yellow room, she did not quite know. But there they were. "That doctor is so stuck on himself." The same words as Harold's very last ones. The tourists would gather seashells and then leave them behind when they left. They left them on the burrows and on the window sills, and May would pick them up and take them back to the beach. At night, when she could not sleep, she would walk downtown to a bar where the young people danced, called the Lucky Kittens, and have a glass of beer. The Lucky Kittens was a loud and careless place where there was dancing all night long. May sat alone at a table near the door, an old lady, dignified and out of place. Bomber was down at the dock, watching tourists arrive on the ferry. The tourists were grinning and ready for anything, they thought. Two boys were playing catch with a tennis ball on the pier, a young boy and an older one in a collared sweatshirt. The younger one sidled back and forth close to the pier's edge, catching in both hands the high lob throws the other boy threw. The water was high and dark and flecked with oil, and they were both laughing like lunatics. Bomber believed they were brothers, and he enjoyed watching them. A girl moved languidly across the dock toward him. She was the pale girl with the perfect pimple, and she touched it delicately as she walked. Her shaved temples had a slight sheen of baby powder on them. Her name was Edith. "I've been thinking," Edith said, "and I think that what they should do, like a gesture is enough. Like for murderers, they could make them wear black all the time. They could walk around, but they'd have to be always in black, and they'd have to wear a mask of some sort." Sometimes Bomber thought of what had happened to his father as an operation. It was an operation they had performed. "A mask," he said. "Hmm." He crossed his arms, tight across his chest. He thought Edith's long, pale face beautiful. She nodded. "A mask," she said. "Something really amazing." "That wouldn't be enough, would it?" Bomber asked. "They wouldn't be able to take it off," Edith said. "There'd be no way." There was a pale vein on her temple, curving like a piece of string. "We didn't believe what you told us, you know," she said. "There was this kid. His name was Alex, and he had a boat. And he said he took this girl water skiing he didn't like. And they were water skiing in this little cove where swans were. And he steered her right in the middle of the swans, and she just creamed them. But he wasn't telling the truth. He's such a loser." "Which one's Alex?" Bomber asked. "Oh, he's around," Edith said. They were silent as the passengers from the ferry eddied around them. They watched the two boys playing catch, the younger one darting from side to side, never looking backward to calculate the space, his eyes only on the softly, slowly falling ball released from his brother's hand. "That's nice, isn't it?" Edith said. "That little kid is so trusting, it's kind of holy. But if his trust were misplaced, it would really be holy." Bomber wanted to touch the vein, the pimple, the shock of dark waxed hair, but he stood motionless, slouched in his clothes. "Yeah," he said. "Like, you know, if he fell in," Edith said. One Sunday, May went to church. It was a denomination that, as she gratefully knew, would bury anyone. She sat in a pew behind three young women and studied their pretty blonde hair, their necks and their collars and their zippers. One of the girls scratched her neck. A few minutes later, she scratched it again. May bent forward and saw a small tick crawling on the girl. She carefully picked it off with her fingers. She did it with such stealth that the girl did not even know that May had touched her. May pinched the tick vigorously between her fingernails for some time, then dropped it to the floor, where it vanished from her sight. After the service, there was a coffee hour. May joined a group around a table that was dotted with plates of muffins, bright cookies, and glazed cakes. When the conversation lagged, she said, "I've just returned from Morocco." "How exotic," the woman exclaimed. "Did you see the Casbah?" The group turned toward May and looked at her attentively. "There are many Casbahs," May said. "I hit tea under a tent on the edge of the Sahara. The children in Morocco all want aspirin. Boom, boom, la tête, they say. Boom, boom, la tête. Their little hands are dry as paper. It's a lack of humidity, I suppose." "You didn't go there by yourself, did you?" a fat woman asked. She was very fat and panted as she spoke. "I went alone, yes," May said. The group hummed appreciatively. May was holding a tiny blueberry muffin in her hand. She couldn't remember picking it up. It sat cupped in the palm of her hand. The paper around it looked like the muffin itself. May had been fooled by such muffins in public places in the past. She returned it to the table. "I saw the blue men," May said. The group looked at her, smiling. They were taller than she, and their heads were tilted toward her. "Most tourists don't see them," May said. "They roam the deserts. Their camels are pale beige, almost white, and the men riding them are blue. They wear deep blue floating robes and blue turbans. Their skin is even stained blue where the dye has rubbed off." "Are they wanderers?" someone asked. "What's their purpose?" May was startled. She felt as though the person were regarding her with suspicion. "They're part of the mystery," she said. "To see them is to see part of the mystery." "It must have been a sight," someone offered. "Oh, yes," May said, "it was." After some moments, the group dispersed, and May left the church and walked home through the town. May liked the town, which is cut off from other places. People came here only if they wanted to. You couldn't find this place by accident. The town seemed to be a place to visit, and most people didn't stay on. There were some, of course, who had stayed on. May liked the clear light of the town and the trees rounded by the wind. She liked the trucks and the jeeps with the dogs riding in them. When the trucks were parked, the dogs would stare solemnly down at the pavement as though there were something astounding there. May felt elated, almost feverish. She had taken up lying rather late in life, and she had taken it up with enthusiasm. Bomber didn't seem to notice, even though he had, in May's opinion, a hurtful obsession with the truth. When May got back to her house, she made herself a cup of tea and changed from her good dress into her gardening dress. She looked at herself in the mirror. "I'm in charge of this person," she thought. "You'd better watch out," she said to the person in the mirror. Bomber's friends never drank or smoked or ate meat. They were bony and wild. In the winter, a psychiatrist came into their classrooms and said, "You think that suicide is an escape and not a permanent departure, but the truth is, it is a permanent departure." They know that. Their eyes watered with boredom. Their mothers used to lie to them when they were little about dead things, but they knew better now. It's stupid to wait for the dead to do anything new. But one of their classmates had killed himself, so the psychiatrist would come back every winter. "They planted a tree," Edith said, "you know, in this kid's memory at school. And what this kid had done was hung himself from a tree." Edith rolled her eyes. "I mean, this school. You're not going to believe this school." Edith and Bomber sat on opposite sides of May's parlor, which was filling with twilight. Edith wore a pair of men's boxer shorts, lace-up boots, and a lurid Hawaiian shirt. "This is a nice house," Edith said. "It smells nice. I see your granny coming out of the kitchen sometimes. She's cute." "The thing I used to remember about my dad," Bomber said, "was that he gave me a TV once when I was little, and he pitched it in the middle of the living room. I slept in it every night for weeks right in the middle of the living room. It was great. But it actually wasn't my dad who had done that at all. It was my grandma." "Your granny is so cute," Edith said. "I know I liked her. Do you know Bobby?" "Which one's Bobby?" Bomber asked. "He's the skinny one with the tooth that overlaps a little. He's the sort of person I used to like. What he does is he fishes. There's not a fish he can't catch." "I can't do that," Bomber said. "Oh, you don't have to do anything like that now," Edith said. The last things May had brought her son
wore a dark suit and a white shirt. They told her she could if she wished, and she had. She had brought him many things in the 2 years before he died. Candy and cigarettes and batteries, books on all subjects, and lastly, she had brought these things. She had bought the shirt new and then washed it at home several times so it was soft, and then she had driven over to that place. It was a cool, misty morning, and the air smelled of chemicals from the mills miles away. Dew glittered on the wires and on the tips of grasses and their fronds of palms. She sat opposite him in the tall, narrow, familiar room, its high windows webby with steel, and he had opened the box with the shirt in it. Together they had looked at it. Together, mutely, they had bent their heads over it and stared. Their eyes had fallen into it as though it were a hole. They watched the shirt, and it seemed to shift and shrink as though to accommodate itself to some ghastly and impossible interstice of time and purpose. "What a shirt," her child said. "Give it back," May whispered. She was terribly frightened. She had obliged some lunatic sense of decorum and dread. The dread that lay beyond the fear of death seized her. "This is the one. I'm going out in this one," her child said. He was thin. His hair was gray. "I wasn't thinking," May said. "Please give it back. I can't think about any of this." "I was born to wear this shirt," her child said. In the Lucky Kittens over the bar was a large painting of kittens crawling out of a sack. The sack was huge, out of proportion to the sea and the sky behind it. When May looked at it for a time, the sack appeared to tremble. One night as she was walking home, someone brushed against her, almost knocking her down, and ran off with her purse. Her purse had $15 in it, and in it, too, were the postcards and pictures of Morocco. May continued to walk home, her left arm still feeling the weight of the purse. It seemed heavier now that it wasn't there. She pushed herself down the street, looking out of habit into the lighted rooms of the handsome homes along the way. The rooms were artfully lit as though on specific display for the passerby. No one was ever seen in them. At home, she looked at herself in the mirror for bruises. There were none, although her face was deeply flushed. "You've been robbed," she said to the face. She went into her parlor. On the floor above, in either the gray room or the yellow room, someone shifted about. Her arm ached. She turned off the light and sat in the dark, rubbing her arm. "The temperature of the desert can reach 175 degrees, she said aloud. "At night it can fall below freezing. Many a time I woke in the morning to find a sheet of ice over the water in the glass beside my bed." It was something that had been written on one of the cards. She could see it all. The writing, the words, plain as day. Sometime later, she heard Balmer's voice. "Grandma," he said, "why are you sitting in the dark?" The light was on again. "Hi," May said. "Sometimes," Balmer said, "she lies out in the garden and the fog rolls in, and she stays right out there." "The fog will be swirling around me," May said, "and Balmer will say, 'Grandma, the fog's rolled in, and there you are.'" She was speaking to a figure beside Balmer with a flamboyant crest of hair. The figure was dressed in silk lounging pajamas and a pair of black work boots with steel toes. "Grandma," Balmer said, "this is Edith." "Hi," Edith said. "What a pretty name," May said. "There's a hybrid lily called Edith, and I like it very much. I'm going to plant an Edith bulb when fall comes." "Will it come up every year?" Edith asked. "Yes," May said. "That is so cool," Edith said. A few days after she had been robbed, May's purse was returned to her. It was placed in the garden just inside the gate. Everything was there, but the bills were different. May had had a 10 and a 5, and the new ones were singles. The cards were there. May touched one and looked at the familiar writing on the back. "It never grows dark in the desert," the writing said. "The night sky is a deep and intense blue, as though the sun were shut up behind it." Her child had been a thoughtful tourist once, sending messages home, trying to explain things she would never see. He had never written from the prison. The thirst for explanation had left him. May thought of death. It was as though someone were bending over her, trying to blow something into her mouth. She shook her head and looked at her purse, turning it this way and that. "Where have you been?" she said to the purse. "The pictures of Morocco over there." She looked through them. All there. But she didn't want them anymore. Things were never the same when they came back. She closed the purse up and dropped it into one of her large green trash cans, throwing some clipped brown flowers over it so that it was concealed. It was less than a week later that everything was returned to her again, once more placed inside the gate. People went through the dump, she imagined. People went through the dump all the time to see what they could find. In town, the young people began calling her by name. May, they'd say, good morning. They'd say, how's it going, Grandma? She was the condemned man's mother, and Bomber was the condemned man's son. And it didn't seem to matter what they did or didn't do. It was he who had been accepted by these people, and he who was allowing them to get it by. Edith was spending more and more time at May and Bomber's house. She ate dinner there several times a week. She had dyed her hair a peculiar brown color and wore scarves knotted around her neck. I like this look, Edith said. It looks like I'm concealing a tracheotomy, doesn't it? Your hair is good, Bomber said. You know what the psychiatrist at school says? Edith said. He says, you think you want death when all you want is change. What is with this guy? Bomber asked. Is there really a problem at that place or what? Oh, there is, absolutely, Edith said. You look a little like your granny. Did your dad look like her? A little, I guess, Bomber said. You're such a bad boy, Edith said. Such a sweet, sweet bad boy. I really love you. The summer was over. The light had changed, and the leaves on the trees hung very still. At the Lucky Kittens, the dancing went on, but not so many people danced. When May went there, they wouldn't take her money, and May submitted to this. She couldn't help herself, it seemed. Edith helped around the house. She washed the windows with vinegar and made chocolate desserts. One evening, she said, "Do you still, like, pay income tax?" May looked at the girl and decided to firmly lie. "No," she said. "Well, that's good," Edith said. "It would be pretty preposterous to pay taxes after what they did." "Of course," May said. "But you're paying in other ways," Edith said. "Please, dear," May said, "it was just a mistake. It doesn't mean anything in the long run," she said, dismayed at her words. "I'll help you pay," Edith said. With the cool weather, the tourists stopped coming. When school began, Edith asked if she could move into the yellow room. She didn't get along with her parents. She had been moving about, staying here and there with friends, but she had no real place to live. Could she live in the yellow room? May was fascinated by Edith. She did not want her in the house above her, living in the yellow room. She felt that she and Bomber should move on, that they should try their new life together somewhere else. But she knew that this was their new life. This was the place where it appeared they had gone. "Of course, dear," May said. She was frightened, and this surprised her, for she could scarcely believe she could know fright again after what happened to them. But there it was. Something beyond the worst thing, some disconnection, some demand. She remembered telling Edith that she was going to plant bulbs in the garden when fall came, but she wasn't going to do it. Certainly not. "No," May said to her garden, "don't even think about it." Edith moved into the yellow room. It was silent there, but May didn't listen either. Something happened later that got around. May was driving. It was night. And the car veered off the road. Edith and Bomber were with her. The car flipped over twice, miraculously righted itself, and skidded back onto the road, the roof and fenders crushed. This was observed by a policeman who followed them for over a mile in disbelief before he pulled the car over. None of them was injured, and at first they denied that anything unusual had happened at all. May said, "I thought it was just a dream, so I kept on going." The three seemed more visible than ever after that, for they drove the car in that damaged way until winter came. I hope you enjoy Joy Williams' The Blue Men. This is Ms. G, and I'm bringing you Telling Tales with Ms. G. So, next week starts our quiet drive here at KTOO. And so I will be on the air, but as a participant, telling you all about Prairie Home Companion and the Quiet Drive. And so then the following weeks, on April 10th, I will be back with more stories, Telling Tales with Ms. G. So tonight, I leave you, and good night, and have a pleasant rest of your week.
Dawa. When we talk about Sandy Beach, Dow gets really, really excited. I think Dow thinks about eating rotten salmon, which would be totally yummy for him, or something else, I'm not really sure. I'm Aubrey Hacker. My parents give him the Quiet Drive, and you can too.
Dow, do you want to go to Sandy Beach?
We'll explore today in this conversation with poet, playwright, and essayist Sonia Sanchez. Named Philadelphia's first poet laureate, she talks about her plans for 2012 and invites the world to participate in her program, Peace is a Haiku Song. Stay with us today to hear Sonia Sanchez, and we'll also find out about the